This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for February 24th, 2005. I'm Amy Brown. Co-host Meredith DeFrancesco is away this week. WERU listeners may be aware that popular Stacks Attracts host Charlie Oldham is awaiting a liver transplant. Today we'll be talking with Charlie and his wife Bonnie about their experience. And we're also joined by Laura Huckstein, a registered nurse from the New England Organ Bank's office in Maine. She'll be telling us about others in our area and how they're impacted by the waiting list for organ donors and what you can do to help. And thank you all for joining us today. Welcome.
Nice to see you, Amy.
And we decided ahead of time that we're going to start with Charlie's story from Charlie and Bonnie's story, and then we're going to talk more general. So, Charlie, do you want to start in giving a little bit of whatever information you want to share?
I'd probably be the best qualified for describing me at this point.
And Bonnie, jump in whenever you want with your perspective.
Sure.
Well, I'll give a real thumbnail version because in lieu of the fundraising attempts since Bonnie and I went public with this situation last fall, people have probably heard possibly as much as they're interested in knowing of the background of this, but I host a show, Stacks Attracts, here. Although I was initially diagnosed with hepatitis back in 1970, and in fact was kept out of Vietnam by it, I was diagnosed with hepatitis C about 8 years ago, and since then have run down to a certain extent. Certain symptoms have accelerated, and I'm really not able to function anything like living a complete life as I once could, coming up to the show every Saturday, although it's a real necessary part of my schedule to keep my spirits up, is still absurdly wearing on me. Without the pain medication I take, I would probably be unconscious all day or have difficulty even getting out of bed. I have some internal discomfort at times, even verging on pain, obviously in the area of my liver, also in the area of my spleen, which often takes the brunt of the abuse and the liver malfunctions because it starts hoarding the blood, things that the blood of various components of the blood that are not being properly processed by the liver. So yeah, I'm hurting some, but more it's this monstrous fatigue, which most people with liver and other immune system impairing diseases will know what I'm talking about. I mean, you could be walking down a city street and have one of the slumps associated with this kind of fatigue syndrome overcome you, and literally, it doesn't look like that irrational thing to simply lie down on the sidewalk in front of full view of passersby. It's as if someone turned the gravity
exhausted.
Up. It makes it impossible to really live a full life. I had to cut my work hours back, and income as a result. But hopefully, that will all be changed after the April 5th date that's now set for me to receive approximately 60% of my younger sister Martha's liver. One full lobe of her liver will be put into me after my old beat one, which, I've wrung every bit of mileage out of, I think, a human being can, will be extracted and hers put in. I'll have a couple, 2 to 3 months of recuperation from that, but I'm looking at a vastly improved quality of life, like being able to have a life from only marginally being able to have having one currently.
So if your sister wasn't able to make the donation, what kind of prospects would you have been facing? And did you know right off the bat that was going to be a solution for you, or how long did it take to find that out?
Well, actually, maybe I'll jump
in Bonnie.
Here. This is Bonnie.
Go ahead, huh?
About, I'd say, 4 years ago, Charlie had a very, very bad episode where he was very sick. This is before we kind of knew how the Hep C was working on his liver, and he has cirrhosis also. And he ended up in the hospital really literally at death's door, and it took a long time for him to recover from that. But it was at that time that his sister Martha, after him being so ill and really kind of realizing the impact of the disease, it was like, oh yeah, people can live with hepatitis their whole lives and never feel any symptoms from it or just feel kind of tired. But this really kind of brought it home, and it was then that his sister Martha said, well, I really seriously thought about it, and I really want to consider being a donor. But it still took a while for her
and her family. She
still
had to be tested for compatibility, obviously, even after that.
And what happens if somebody wants to be a donor? Does the
person who needs an organs insurance cover all of the medical expenses for the person who's making the donation? What about?
Well, not all of them. I must say that in this regard, as well as in having my sister standing up and being counted as a living donor for me, not only am I extremely lucky in that regard, the other regard in which I'm lucky is that my employer has insurance that covers it. Even so, we're looking at many thousands of dollars in associated fees that the insurance, with their ever-tightening ratio of services to cost, shall we say, on the consumer end, are squeezing out, that we don't know exactly what it's going to be, but it's going to be tens of thousands of dollars left uncovered by. And I'm a person with insurance. You know, I'm one of the lucky ones. And if the trend in insurance in Maine continues to shift from HMOs to PPOs, you know, it's going to cut down even more the number of people that have any kind of backing to pursue what is, in my case, I don't think I'm exaggerating the case, clearly a necessity for an acceptable quality of life.
Yeah, the insurance does pay for all Martha's medical expenses, not all Charlie's, almost all. But we also have, you have so many costs, the hotels,
getting Martha up here,
the
my
airfare,
lost wages
the
from work.
Lost wages.
Jumbo just, prescription bills regularly, the co-pays from office visits and stuff.
So she does have expenses also because she'll be out of work for a while.
And again, I'm one of the lucky ones. If Martha, my sister, had not been willing to do this, I'd have been on a waiting list, which would have been a minimum of 3 to 4 year wait because one then is waiting on an organ from a cadaver and must be the sickest on the list. And the criteria by which they judge that sickness, frequently people die. Laurie, you mentioned a number of 17 people per day, I believe, that die needing organs that would have saved them.
Laura, why don't you go ahead and jump in here and at this point and tell us how familiar is this story and how is Charlie's story different? It sounds like he's fortunate in some ways in that he has a living donor. Is that unusual, or are people typically able to get someone in their family to give them a section of their liver if they need one?
Currently, liver donation from a living donor is very unusual. It's a very complicated surgery. There is risk not only to the donor, but like Charlie was saying, there's also some problems with loss of income, with recovery time and things like that. A lot of families cannot afford to be out for that long. So most of the liver, people who are on the waiting list for a liver transplant, those kind of transplants, they are waiting for a cadaver or somebody who has died and whose family has made that decision to donate their organs. Charlie is one of 92,000 people that are currently on the waiting list for life-saving organ transplants. And like he said, 17 people a day die waiting while on the waiting list. And, you know, if you take that and you put it in perspective, it's Charlie's, it's the Charlie's, it's the moms, it's the dads, it's the children, the grandparents. All of these people are somebody's loved one. So it really is mind-boggling when you think about all of the people that are affected by transplantation.
And the waiting lists are a little bit complicated. It's not, they have a lot of different factors they have to weigh in terms of who gets moved to the top of the waiting list.
I'm told it was at the Kinsey Institute where the MELD score was first, I don't know where it came from. It's a means of using several criteria, including several liver indicators that indicate how the liver is being stressed in blood tests, but other factors of the progression of the disease as well are averaged out into what's called a MELD score. In a healthy person, that number would probably hover around 7. In a person who's, you know, on their deathbed waiting for a transplant, which if they don't get soon, they'll be too sick to get it, is about 40. My score is at about 15. So you can see there's a long way to go during the 3 or 4 years I would be waiting for a liver. There's a long way down to go. And not much to cushion it. There's, you know, unlike the when other organs quit, Laura mentioned there were alternative means of propping up someone whose liver is going south to an extent they have not yet devised for the liver. If their kidney is going south, they can be on dialysis, which is not comfortable. But so
what happens to people in that time between when they're getting sick and it's an effort to walk down the street even and the time when they are seriously ill enough to be scored at the top of the waiting list for a donor? Do you see people losing their jobs and their insurance in the meantime? Or?
Well, I think that the biggest thing about organ donation and what Charlie's talking about is they've tried to devise a system that would be equal and fair to everybody. So it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're famous or if you're just a Joe citizen like myself. They try to devise a system that you're put on a waiting list and that it's a fair system so that you will get your organ when your turn has come up or when you're at the top of the list. Now, every so often there is a situation where, for example, somebody who had just gotten a liver transplant, if something happened, there was a complication and the liver stopped working automatically after that first transplant. You know, you need a liver to survive, so they would pop them to the top of the list. That's rare. They won't jump somebody to the top of the list. They don't do that. The system is highly regulated. It's many people go over that. So it's a pretty fair system, and there is a ranking. And being on the donation side and doing organ allocation, I can tell you we don't skip over the list. We start from the first person that's at the top of the list waiting all the way down. So,
are there any factors that keep people off the list entirely?
One thing is I think that when physicians list their patients, the transplant surgeons list their patients, they want to make sure that these people who are going to receive the transplants will be able to take care of these precious organs. They're getting their life back, but at the same time, somebody else has lost their life. And, you know, when you're talking to a family who has just lost a loved one, offering them the option of donation, you want to make sure that they know that whoever's receiving this is receiving the best gift that they could have ever gotten and that they are going to take care of that gift. So they'll make sure that their lifestyle is they're equipped to take care of their new gift, their new organ, and that means taking their medications as scheduled. That means, you know, regular checkups and all of that. Also, anything that's, you know, unhealthy in their lifestyle, whether they had a problem with smoking, they'll make sure that they're off of cigarettes, that they're not smoking. They've been in a cessation program for a period of time, and then they'll do random tests to make sure. Because you don't want somebody who just gets a lung transplant to start smoking again. I mean, that's a precious gift, and they're giving, you know, they're wasting that. So, you know,
I think it's important for people to know that the people who receive a liver transplant are monitored because there are a fair number of incidents where the loss of the liver is attributable to lifestyle problems and excesses. And a person who is considering a loved one's organs being donated would feel vastly more reassured to know that these people are assessed as being drug and alcohol free.
Yes.
On an ongoing basis before they can even qualify to undergo get on the list.
So if somebody is struggling with addiction at the time, who makes the determination that they've made enough progress in their recovery to be able to be on the list? Is it their personal physician, or is there some kind of standardized way of determining that?
Well, the transplant physician, the one who would be doing the transplant, there's a program, and they have to make sure that these people have gone to a cessation program, a proven program. They usually require them to be drug or alcohol free for at least 6 months after they've gone through the program. And then they'll do random testing, whether it's urine or blood testing, to make sure there's no drugs or alcohol. If at any time they find out there is, they will take them immediately off the list and most likely not re-put them on the list until there's other measures that they've gone through.
That something's changed. What about insurance? Is that a factor in whether or not you get to be on the list?
No. No, it doesn't matter. If you have no insurance or if you have the best insurance, you know, you get put on the list and it goes according to where you are on that list. So even if you have no money.
That's right. They never ask us when we went through the evaluation process. No one ever asked us if we had insurance.
That was not a factor.
Yeah.
And with the hospitals as well, they will go ahead and do the surgeries and cover that piece of it and then deal with the financial aspects later.
I can't imagine anyone who doesn't have insurance paying for it. It's
For us with insurance, it's a substantial burden on top of what's been coming out of our pocket for the last several years. So a person without insurance, I don't know how that would be handled, frankly. I don't. You know, I certain things would be waived, but even us with insurance still have substantial not things that are not covered or in which the insurance company has developed a differing nomenclature for, say, we'll insure the surgical procedure, but your hospital stay is now co-insured, which seems to be a term used this year to, you know, the current bogus term for we'll only cover up to a percentage, not the whole thing, with a ceiling on your out-of-pocket expenditure.
I kind of would like to jump in here and talk about how when we found out about the transplant and the extra costs, that we really struggled with going public with all of this. But we thought, well, maybe it's the thing to do. And it was kind of a strange thing because we wrote a letter. We've done fundraisers. We kind of went out there that we need help. And it's kind of a humbling thing, but yet so many people have come forward, people we don't know, our family members. People have just been so wonderful. And I do encourage other people. I think that we did the right thing because that's one thing that's going to be relieved from our minds. There's so much stuff to get together. But that part of it's like, okay, you know, people have been helping. And I thought, well, if I had a friend who had something like this, I would want to help.
Yeah, a number of people who have helped us have said, you know, geez,
we wish more people would
be less stolid and, you know,
but it was kind of like
things.
Well, I think you assume that if somebody has I mean, we know there's a huge problem in this country with the uninsured, 45 million people without insurance at all. Mm-hmm. But I think most of us assume that if we did have insurance, that at least the catastrophic things would be covered. And
well, that's
this
true.
Is something that's catastrophic.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah. But with the dwindling numbers of people who are covered by insurance at all, even that bulwark or that margin between them and catastrophe is reduced, you know, with each passing year. But even the number of people that are so protected. But really, I think that has obviously been at least a peripheral subject in many of your shows. And what I think is very specific to this conversation between the four of us is that a lot of people out there are in a position to do something to really help someone in my position who's looking at the possibility of having a restored quality of life, not having to live through even the simplest of life functions, by considering organ donation, which a lot of people are perhaps in principle agreed to until the person out of whom the organs are coming goes from being an abstract hypothetical figure to being Uncle Herbert. And a lot of people, you know, balk at the idea of Uncle Herbert's innards being carved up and carted off. Although those same people, as I think you pointed out to me in an earlier conversation, Laura, are not really protected from that to the extent they think, and that involving autopsies and things of this sort are all invasive procedures to a similar degree. And what a donated organ can do for a person in my position, even compared to getting a cadaveric organ from a cadaver, the survival rates are better for living donors in the specific areas that we've researched it and so forth. People often think that because they've got it filled in their license, you know, their driver's license, that they've attended to that and they can, you know, sort of move on to thinking of something else. But in reality, the truth is that unless your family members are alerted to your desires, they probably and understandably will move to head them off.
Laura, why don't you go ahead and jump in here with that and starting with maybe why, what do you hear from people? What is the reasoning behind not wanting to, well, as your pen says, donate life?
I think that one of the major things is these families that are in the process of losing a loved one, usually it's sudden, it's unexpected. They're forced to make many different decisions, one which may be organ donation. If they don't know what their loved one wanted, it makes the decision all the more difficult for them, because not only are they worrying about that, but they're worrying about, well, you know, did they want to be cremated? Did they want to be buried? You know, what am I going to do about that? What about their finances? There's so many things things that these families have to go through, when really, in fact, all you know they should have to go through is grieving the loss of their loved one. All of these decisions should have been made for them so that they're comfortable and they know that when they go into that and when that time comes that they'll have those decisions made. So one of the things that I see is they've had have to make so many decisions that's just one more. You know, like Charlie said, a lot of them say things like, oh, you know, I don't want him cut on. Yet, you know, they're in the hospital, you know, most of them have probably had something taken out, whether it's their appendix or, you know, whether it's their gallbladder or things like that. So it's not the fact that they're getting cut on, I think. You know, most surgeries you have to have an incision, and that's what this is. I think that people believe that there's dismemberment, and there really isn't. It's a very dignified surgery. It's like open heart surgery. You know, these people that are donors are heroes to all of us. You know, they're the unsung heroes that you never get to hear about, but are saving a lot of lives. So I think the most important thing is for families to talk to one another, to tell each other their wishes. Another interesting thing is if you ask majority of the population whether or not they'd accept an organ to save their lives or the lives of somebody that they love, most of them are going to say yes. Yet, in actuality, when it comes down to it, less than 50% or less than half of the people that are asked about organ donation say yes. So more than 50% say no to organ donation, yet those same people would probably say yes to save their loved one's life with an organ. So there's a very big imbalance in that system right there.
Well, that's a different dynamic, though, than the people, the grieving relatives trying to decide what to do. You're talking about when people who are living are surveyed about whether or not they would donate an organ, 50% or more of them are saying that they would not?
No. What I'm saying is that when the time comes, people who are polled prior to organ donation, or, you know, like us who are right now healthy, if we were asked, you know, what do you think about organ donation, 85% of us would say, yes, we think it's a great thing and we'd be an organ donor. Okay. Yet when the time comes and their families have had to make decisions about their loved ones whether or not to be an organ donor, less than half say yes to organ donation. Now, in that same circumstance where their loved one is gravely ill, if they were asked, you know, in order for your loved one to live, they need a heart transplant, will you accept it? Most of them would say yes. Hmm. So, you know, where less than half would say yes to donation, you know, more than 90% would say yes to transplantation.
Receiving it.
Yeah.
So what are the 85% of people who say when they're healthy that they would be an organ donor need to do to make sure that they their wishes are carried out later on when it's time?
There's a number of things that you can do. First of all, make your wishes known to your family. Make sure that they know what you want. You want to make your family as comfortable as possible. Death's never easy. You know, the one thing I always talk about when I talk to everybody is it's going to happen to every single one of us. If we talk about it, if we tell our families what our wishes are, it just makes it that much easier on them so that they can grieve your loss and not have to worry about all the decisions and all of the things that hadn't been taken care of. So make sure your family knows what your wishes are. You can put something in a living will. You can put something on your license. The state of Maine is now recognizing the intent of the donor, which means if you have a legal document or if it's on your license that you would like to be an organ donor, we will honor your wishes. There is an out clause right now that will probably be taken out this year, which says if the majority of your family doesn't agree with your decision, they can say no.
Right, and that's what we've heard about recently is that your family could override
your wishes.
But how is that going to be changing?
If there's a legal indication of what you want if you want to be a donor and you've put it legally, whether it's on your license or a living will or a donor card, we will honor that regardless of what your family wants for you because you've made that decision. You've made a conscious decision to put it on your license or put it in a living will or what have you. We will honor your wishes.
And when you say we will honor your wishes, can you say a little bit more about what exactly how you do that, how you know what people's wishes are and this database that's going to be coming about?
The state of Maine is currently, their DMV is revamping their database so that all of the information that's currently on your license will be captured in a statewide database that's in the process of being put into place. It was supposed to be done last January, and I hear that this summer sometime it's going to be done. So once that's in place, place, all of the information that's on your license will be put into this database, including whether or not you want to be an organ donor. Working with New England Organ Bank, I would be able to access only that portion of your license. So just your name, and based on your name, whether or not you made an indication of whether or not you wanted to be a donor, I'll be able to access, and then be able to bring it to the family and say, you know, your loved one had this wish on their license. I would like to honor their wishes. This is what we need to do to go forward.
So the hospitals communicate with your organization or your department when someone passes away, and then you're able to look that up and find out.
Right.
And what about the timeliness of that? Charlie was asking that earlier about how much time passes while people are in our organs preserved.
Yeah, hospitals are required to report all deaths to the New England Organ Bank and all impending deaths, so that we're usually in Maine. I'll tell you one thing I would like your listeners to know. Maine is a very generous state. We have very high consent rates. Maine is a very giving state. One of the things that I get a kick out of, I moved here from Indianapolis. I've never seen so many benefit dinners, bean suppers. Any day of the week you could eat somewhere. It's just an overwhelming generous state. So we see that when we talk to families about organ donation too. Most of them, given the chance to save a life, will do it. So, you know, if in the hospitals in the state of Maine, they'll call, you know, either at the time of death or prior to, and then we'll come in and talk to the family if there's an option for donation.
And let's end with maybe Charlie and Bonnie, just in a nutshell, can say where you're at now, what you all need, and then we'll hear the same in terms of what people can do from your perspective, Laura.
Well, as at the outset of this conversation, I still need me a new liver. Hopefully that's scheduled for April.
It looks like you've got one coming.
Got one wrapped up in butcher paper heading this way. Aside from the people who have helped us, not only by attending these benefits and so forth, but the people, you know, the good friends who have taken an astounding amount of the work of putting them on off of our shoulders, we're deeply thankful and appreciative. And, you know, I've lived in cities all over this country for most of my adult life, and I don't think I've ever really found a community as generous, as Laura just said, as we've found here on the mid-coast of Maine, and that such a community would claim Bonnie and I as members is, you know, in light of these events, an honor we'll strive to be worthy of. But April 5th will be the date. I'll be down for a few months, and then Mark Elwin has consented to fill in on Stacks of Tracks, and I've got someone lined up to fill in on my day job at the Island Institute, where I lay out the newspaper, The Working Waterfront. And hopefully sometime in June, I'll be back in the saddle.
Good to see you back around.
You know, the little liver that said, I can't do this anymore, will be gone, and we'll have a new model in who will, you know, think he can. Okay?
Any last thoughts, Bonnie? Anything that people could be doing to help or offer support for you?
Well, they are. Our friends have been very generous, and we'd like to thank them publicly. And it's...
Geez, thank them. We'd like to slobber at their feet, lick the hem of their garments and so forth.
And we're just kind of trying to get things lined up now. Since we know what's coming, we're trying to get everything all straightened out. And I'm really glad that I have a part-time job right now so I can be doing some of this, because a lot of it does fall on the spouse. So, but things have been going well, and we're just waiting for that April 5th and beyond.
Great, thanks.
Great new world.
And Laura Huckstein from the Maine office of the New England Organ Bank, how can people get in touch with you for more information? What do they need to be, what can they be doing if they want to help out?
Any information that you would like about organ donation, you can go on our website, which is www.neob.org. And the most important thing you can do is talk to your family about your wishes. Make sure they know what you want. And that's the best thing you can possibly do.
Great. Thank you very much, Charlie and Bonnie Oldham and Laura Huckstein. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Joel Mann engineered today's program. Andy Buckley does web and technical support. You can reach us here at WERU or by emailing radioactive@maineindymedia.org. And we have a new website where you can download our archived programs. That's radioactivenews.org. Thanks for listening and acting, and stay tuned to your community radio station, WERU, for more independent news. Thank you.
We'll be right back.